Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name's Michael O'Connell. I'm here today with Megan Clougherty. And today we're going to be talking about covering the federal government, in particular covering food issues around the USDA. Today we've got Jason Huffman and Amber Healy of the Food Chemical News. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. So tell us about the Food Chemical News. What is it? What does it do? Who's your audience, and what is it you're trying to get? What information are you trying to get out there?
Well, Food Chemical News has been around for almost 55 years now, and we cover food regulation. Our audience is a fairly mixed bag of different types of professionals. A lot of our readers are in the food industry, food company executives. We also have government officials who read our publication, consumer advocates, attorneys, consultants who serve the food industry. Some of them sue the food industry as well. You know, it's anybody who's concerned with food regulation, and that's a large number of people.
Okay, and how does that, you know, how do you approach that as a journalist? I mean, what is it you're, does it present any special challenges for you?
Oh, yeah, because there's a lot of information on the food industry out there. So we're a subscriber-based product, so we have to deliver a high-level, down-in-the-weeds type of content. And we do that by really getting to understand the regulations and then covering, getting into the sort of the nuances of the regulations. What does it mean? Also, we have to kind of be inside the beltway, what's coming, what's happening, you know, before it actually gets to the Federal Register, what's being worked on. And then there are all these things that happen in and around Washington that don't necessarily make it into the Federal Register, and we have to be on top of all of that. It's a, you know, the food industry is the largest industry in the world. It's a $4.6 trillion industry, and there's a lot of focus and emphasis on it. And there's a lot of content, you know, being provided in this area. So we have to do something beyond what people can normally find.
So is there concern that, I mean, the tone of what you're writing, is it strictly sort of, you know, you're talking, you know, people inside the beltway to people who understand the jargon of what you're doing? Or do you try to, you know, present your stuff in a way that people, you know, the average citizen can, you know, understand the importance and weight of it?
We're not really writing to the average citizen so much as the professional. Mm-hmm. Our primary focus is the person who's, you know, kind of familiar with the food industry and usually has a general familiarity of the regulations that are out there. We're really trying to satisfy the professionals, the mm-hmm. people who are actually doing something in their occupation that relates to this.
Now, this is probably the best point for me to offer a little inside information. Actually, I worked with Amber Healy for about 5 years at the Connection Newspapers in Northern Virginia. She was a reporter who worked for me, writing some very...
You were blessed in that case.
I was blessed. She's an excellent writer, reporter. Very good at writing features, and I don't mean that in a light sense that, you know, these are the flowery stories, but would, you know, really good identifying the people aspect of it. Did you find it a challenge to write this type of...
It was a lot harder at first when I got there because I was used to writing to a community. You know, I was writing about schools. I was writing about, in one case, one legendary case, groundwater pollution.
Well, which was a scientific story.
Which was a very nerdy story.
Yeah.
I had to call, you know, CDC and different agencies, DEQ, to find out what was the problem with finding the stuff in the water behind a brand new townhouse development where there was a nice shiny playground on top of it and little kids were playing there. And, you know, how big a problem was this really? Transitioning to government writing, where you're dealing with people who are, you know, fully invested in what you're writing about, whether it's regulation or policy or new testing methods for pathogens, it's a whole different world. And it was a little challenging at first to get rid of my newspaper feature voice to transition into more of a business voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different language. It's a whole different world. It's a whole different list of acronyms that make sense to nobody unless you're in that world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in some ways it helped, too, because I understand how to, like, break down the science of something to make it easier for people to understand if they're interested, but they might not know it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, being at the Connection for as long as I was there, I think that helped.
Yeah, and I run into that challenge sometimes, too, is that you, when you're covering the government, sometimes you get into it and you're like, you know, A, you have to figure out how it makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, okay, well, how am I going to present this in a way to my readers so that they can understand it's important? I mean, it's challenging to, you know, recognizing the fact that you've got an audience who knows a lot of stuff that,
right.
that you know, a lot of the shortcuts and information. So, you know, not making it too dumb for them, but also making it interesting for them.
I think you guys are hitting on the biggest anxiety that I've run into with new reporters in the newsletter area, and that is that they're used to writing to people who are like them if they come from the newspaper world, who they can kind of relate to. And then they get into this area where they're writing to these professionals, and they think, you know, how am I going to, you know, give these people something they don't know? How am I going to present this in a way that I'll be speaking their language? And that's a difficult transition that you have to make. I had a journalist one time who came up to me after about 2 years on the job, and she said, you know, Jason, I feel like a poser. You know, I feel like I'm faking it here. And, you know, that you always have that insecurity when you get into this stuff. But Amber actually does an outstanding job of presenting the information that way. She's really good at getting sort of inside the subject and then an understanding herself, and then turning around and saying, okay, how do I present this now to these readers who are at a different level?
Yeah, and you've actually been out in the field in this. You were telling me once you went out to Nebraska to...
Oh, yeah. That was shortly after I started at Food Chem News. I had an opportunity to go to Omaha with the then Undersecretary of Food Safety and the Secretary of Agriculture on like a 2.5-day trip. And it was... it was really interesting. I got a lot of, you know, really close one-on-one time, more with the undersecretary, a gentleman by the name of Richard Raymond, who is still a source. He's out in Colorado now. He's retired. But it was a really interesting way to see not just how the government worked, but how the industry worked as well. We visited a couple slaughter facilities. You don't learn your job better when you're talking about meat safety than going into a slaughter facility. and no, I'm not a vegetarian. People ask me that all the time.
That it didn't change your outlook.
When you grow up on a farm, you kind of always know that the cow in the pasture is going to be your dinner someday.
You're just looking around, say, I could eat that if I need to.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, it brings up the question of sources, though, because when you work inside an industry and you're writing to that industry, do you guys find it easier to get sources because they know who your audience is? Or do you find it sort of like,
sometimes.
I mean, just a little more difficult because they all know each other?
It kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah, it does.
There are sources that love us because when we call them, they can immediately jump into the conversation and know that we understand what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are some organizations that would rather talk to the Washington Post.
And you're always going to have that.
They perceive the Washington Post as being more high profile and... So they'll take that call ahead of us. You know,
this has been an ongoing sort of subtext to this podcast, is that every once in a while we talk about the fact that when you're in Washington, you're a working journalist, and then there's the Washington Post.
Well, but that's like that in any, you know, I'm sure in New York they have that problem too.
Yeah, the New York Times.
I can't imagine who the New York Times, since it says, oh man, I can't believe they're talking to whatever,
no,
but they're not talking to us. I don't think that happens.
What's your name again? Yeah. Amber and I. Amber and I had an incident where we were covering this arts facility down in Lorton, Virginia. And we had done all this wonderful, you know, they were building it. It was this huge thing. We followed it through the development, through the county structure and everything.
From a prison.
It was a huge story for our newspaper. And then they were going to have this big reception with Baryshnikov there.
Yeah.
And we weren't invited. And yet the Washington Post was. And
we raised
a bit of a stink about it. And
so bitter.
Oh, no, we were big babies about it.
How long ago was this?
This was a few years ago.
I'm glad you're not holding on to anything.
No. And so I called up and, you know, was the indignant editor. And so we ended up getting Amber at the event. But, you know, that's every once in a while you have to kind of stand up and say, look, you know, we're in the trenches here. We're covering you guys day in and day out. You know, like, give us the opportunity to do our jobs.
Yeah.
Tell us about your website. Tell us about, I mean, obviously, you know, you told us who your audience was, but if I'm a journalist coming to your website wanting to find specific information about something that's coming up, either legislatively or whatever, I mean, is it easy to navigate? Is it easy to figure out what's
what? If you're a subscriber,
yes. Oh, okay.
It's a couple $1,000 to subscribe to our publication.
Yeah, okay.
So it's more like a newsroom would be.
Yeah, we're a subscriber-based model. We don't take advertising, so that, you know, that requires that we put up walls around our website, and the content is not readily available. If you could see the headlines in the first paragraph of every story, mm-hmm. If you wanted more content and you were a journalist covering a beat, I would say shoot me an email or contact me using the information on the website, and I'll probably want to help you because, you know, like we were talking earlier about the story that broke this past week,
right?
Where some newspapers picked up our article, gave us credit, And that's good publicity for us. So we don't mind occasionally having a story kind of get out into the mainstream press.
So, you know, this is an interesting sort of topic to talk about. Our subscriber base, there are a lot of subscriber-based publications, you know, certainly industry, where they've got a particular target audience. You're providing a level of expertise coverage that these people in the industry and people the experts want to get. You know, how does that function? I mean, are you looking for more readers to come in, and do you feel that you reach a certain level of interest?
I think the focus on a lot of the sort of the mainstream press is to find advertising. They always have to worry about will we get enough advertising to pay for things. In our world, we have to worry about subscribers. We have to have constant marketing efforts to attract new readers. But that's how we pay for things. And as journalists, you try not to think about that too much, but basically at the end of the day, to have a job, you need to have subscribers.
Yeah, do you find it a difficulty to have your content sort of walled off from average readers, or it might be casual readers? Does that present any particular difficulties for you in getting new subscribers?
We're all egotistical, basically, as journalists. We like having our byline on stuff.
I like
people
competitive
reading.
Better.
And the more readers, competitive.
I'm competitive.
We would love to have more people reading our copy. I mean, ideally, that would be great for us. But the reality is, if we did that, obviously we wouldn't have subscribers. So,
it's sort of that odd thing that. And I think it really kind of hinges on what you were saying before about, places like the New York Times, the Washington Post are putting up walls that they're having to deal with, a model where they're coming off of making all their money off of advertising.
Well, it's also interesting because they're an industry publication. So if they had advertisers, they would likely had already covered their advertisers or might cover their advertisers.
There are publications that are in the industry that. That are more industry oriented, that are advertising based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have struggled though in terms of, I think every business model, that's one of the things I like about your show, because journalism is going through this kind of weird period of trying to figure itself out, and the business model is a big part of that. How do you pay for journalism? Mm-hmm. And the subscription based model has suffered as well. I mean, we haven't had great years recently. I got into this back in the 90s on a couple other beats. And, times were good, when this model was kind of fresh and new, but we're struggling just like everybody else. But I don't think the advertising-based world's doing that much better.
So neither one of them's the right answer.
Yeah.
I hope we can sort this out soon, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to stay working in this profession,
that's one of the – it's funny you say that, Amber, because actually all the people that we've talked to, I think, have generally been optimistic about sort of the future of journalism. They all recognize that the business model issue is something that's being hammered out. It's been being hammered out for the last 10 years or so. And people, I think, are optimistic that, journalism is not going to go away, that there's just this need for it. It's just how it's going to happen.
I keep telling myself that to get to sleep at night. there's a need for content. And will that need ever go away? I can't see that. And there will be a need for people who are specialists in content, who understand a particular topic and can deliver that content. It's just a matter of how are we going to pay for it. I just don't see. I mean, the food industry, like I mentioned earlier, is huge.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there are people in the food industry who need this information like their life depended on it.
Yeah. And that's not, and that's actually, I don't want to call it necessarily luxury, but that's something nice to know that you're writing stuff that is clearly, valued by a certain section of the audience. So, and that's the way you turn, the business model and anything. You create something of value that your audience is willing to pay for, at least to seek you out for.
Any type of business model, any type of journalist needs to figure out who their readers are and what they want. And then you try to write for that particular reader and you try to deliver high-value content. Because let's be honest, even if your content's free, you still have to struggle against other publications that are delivering content that's also free. And you have to make your story as attractive as, or desirable as anybody else's.
Are you concerned at all about industry and the government? Do you have any concerns at all about keeping your independence in your voice and your coverage?
Actually, one of the things about being subscriber-driven, it does give us a certain amount of freedom. We don't have to worry too much about a major advertiser pulling out. Mm-hmm. We have enough readers and enough subscribers that if someone didn't like what we wrote, because, and I mean, as long as I just care that it's fair and balanced. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate to quote the Fox Network.
But well, it's a good tagline for a reason, I guess.
But as long as it's you know, it's got those bases covered, we're going to present the content. We don't have to worry too much about it.
Now, you've sort of got a side project going on that's kind of interesting. You launched a YouTube TV show, the Knife and Fork Show.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Is that just that you can't stop talking about food that you need to
I'm
do?
I'm so excited. I want to find other ways to talk about food. It's been about a year almost when I started working on this. And I was kind of interested in a couple of things. I wanted to expand my own areas of sort of, you know, journalism skills, just kind mm-hmm. of when to get into different places. And simultaneously, I felt like being a subscription-based product, we needed a venue where we could kind of provide content that was not, didn't have walls around it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there wasn't anything like what I was thinking about in terms of a sort of a videotaped or a recorded talk show on food regulation. I thought I would create it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the and that's the way a lot of these things get done, is that you recognize that there's a need and says, well, hell, I'll just go ahead and do it. Is it just you and Amber and other reporters, or do you bring people in to interview?
Well, once every month we get we run a studio in Arlington that's made available by Arlington Independent Media, which is the local cable company. And we bring in all of our typical sources, some really well-recognized names in the food industry. You may not know their names, but the food industry knows who these people
are. Rock stars in the
they're
food
rock stars in the food industry. They are. And they're usually in the Washington, D.C. area, and there's a lot of these folks in the Washington, D.C. area. And we get them to stop by the studio, and we film a couple interviews. And then over the course of a month, I put these interviews out on YouTube and on our website and you know, whoever else wants to run those videos.
And how are the numbers doing comparatively? I mean, has it grown, or are people responding to it pretty
well? Yeah,
it's
starting to get a little traction. One of the things that I did was I started using social media, LinkedIn in particular, to kind of sort of let people know about the videos. And so we're starting to get, you know, just got a couple hundred viewers at a time. And you know, that's small potatoes when you're in a consumer-based broadcast or print media. Mm-hmm. But in the world of subscription-based products, that's not a bad number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's still new. I mean, who knows where this is going to be in 6 months or a year? I mean, this could take off and...
Yeah.
Well, you're talking to podcasters, so we know that this is all faith.
We're optimistic that it's going to work out really well.
I actually started, I was on a different beat. I was covering telecom a couple of years ago, and I started off by doing a podcast similar mm-hmm. to this. We didn't have all this nice equipment.
No.
That's how I kind of started getting interested in the other forms of media. You Megan, you came in through broadcast.
Yeah.
So this is all sort of
potatoes for you.
It's exciting in a way because everyone's starting to sort of branch out right now and maybe, hey, I'm going to try some video, or I might try a little, you know, podcasting or
all of it.
Yeah, and then just throw it on our websites and see if it works. And I think that's what we've been talking about lately, is it's kind of exciting that, you know, when you have to do something to change it up, people try different things and, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you never know what you're going to get out of it. So I think it's a good thing.
I feel like all journalists right now should be exploring the different medias, because I think there's going to be a day when we might be required, have different skill sets like this.
Well, I think it's a good point to make, because a lot of the journalists we've spoken with recently, I mean, their jobs have changed even in the last 2 or 3 years. They've had to do more. You know, and do different mediums even than what they came in doing. Have you guys found that as well?
Yeah, I haven't had a direct pressure applied from my company or anywhere else that sort of says, you got to get into this. But I've heard stories about other journalists like mm-hmm. that. Either way, I mean, you know, there are plenty of journalists in this market, in this area, and having just another skill set is, you know, it's a competitive advantage.
Now, one of the other things is, you know, I'm sitting here looking at you. You've got a copy of your the food chemical news in front
it's
of
actually
you.
Actually, our handbook of this.
Your handbook.
Year ahead.
But you also you publish a newsletter as well mm-hmm. as doing your content. Is the content the same on both?
You know what I do? I kind of cheat.
getting all the secrets.
I'm the editor
out.
Of the publication, so I don't have a lot of bandwidth to get into to do a lot of reporting myself right now. Mm-hmm. I rely on these reporters to do that. So when they get a good story or something that's really interesting, I'll piggyback on that and I'll grab maybe a source they might have interviewed or someone I know who can talk about the topic. Mm-hmm. And using the reporting they've already done, I can go into an interview on camera and really kill it for like 10 minutes. And I'm riding off of their backs, you know, because they've done all of this initial legwork. They've done all the research.
You're like a parasite.
I am. I'm a parasite.
So
not my words, not by the way.
No, just your thoughts. I can still read your mind.
I say nothing.
I find what you do is really, really kind of interesting and really speaks to an area of journalism that people don't always think about, that it's, you know, industry-based, it's business-based, expertise-based. You know, being able to, you know, how can somebody who's coming out of a journalism school or who maybe has a degree in the sciences or something like that get into this type of industry?
I used to speak with more confidence about this than I can today, because it's really interesting what's happening out there now. You know, when I coach young journalists, what I typically tell them is I tell them to be open to different kinds of media, but I do tell them to focus on a particular area of specialty that they're interested in, because they can take that and that can give them an advantage. If someone was coming at this from a professional background, let's say they were a food scientist,
right,
and they wanted to be in the journalism area, I actually think that's a more difficult climb. Some people can write, some people can report, and some people can't. It's something you can get better at, but I think it's more difficult to do that than it is to learn the area of specialty that, you know, if you've already got the journalism skills.
Yeah, and we come out of journalism schools generally as generalists in a way that we have a lot of these skills that, you know, reporting, interviewing, listening.
I think that's the way you and I came out of journalism
school.
Yeah,
but it's changing.
I think increasingly it's becoming, you know, more what I describe.
There's a struggle going on. I mean, there's a struggle. Thank you, Internet, for screwing up everything.
Exactly.
It's a struggle going on in everything. The people we talk to in journalism education are recognizing that, you know, they've got to get up on their heels and try to figure out, you know, what their customers, and they are customers, need to know in order to, when they get out in 4 years, that they have something that's viable to maybe them get a job or at least to develop some sort of career. You know, multimedia, definitely, you know, picking up all these skills. Now, I want to go back to social media. You talked a little bit about LinkedIn. Do you guys do any other social media?
I created a Facebook page for the show, the Knife and Fork Show.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, YouTube, I guess, and LinkedIn. I think that's pretty much. I don't use Twitter. A lot of people talk about Twitter. I probably ought to get to maybe more familiar with it. But my marketer actually uses Twitter. But I just kind of, you know, LinkedIn's has been my sort of go-to.
And you know, I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about LinkedIn, because we actually, you know, when you found out that I was doing the show, we exchanged some emails, and you had some really good advice about getting into LinkedIn that I've kind of seen bear a degree of fruit. LinkedIn is kind of a mysterious sort of social media, because it seems like on the one level it's just, okay, here's where your resume is. And then, here's some people I know from my office. But, you know, how do you leverage that into, you know, getting your content out there? And, you know, what are some of the things that you do?
Well, you know, it's amazing. LinkedIn is kind of developing every day, I think, into something different. When I first got into it, I was finding a lot of people who I could relate to, who were sources, potential contacts in my area. But now I've got like 650 contacts, and I'm in like probably 30 different chat groups, actually 50 different chat groups now. And a lot of them are in the area of food regulation, and there's different specialties within food regulation. Mm-hmm. And these are all chat groups that have been formed over the last year or so. And so what I do with the way I use those groups is I'll take my videos and I'll put them on the chat group and then kind of invite comment. People will go check the video out from the chat group. People, if someone says they like it, it hangs out on the top of the, you know, the page. And it gets more hits. So it's created a buzz, you know, around what we're doing. I think there are people who know my newsletter now from, it's kind of a three-step process. We have the newsletter, then the video, and then LinkedIn. And I think they had a channel back from LinkedIn to the newsletter.
Go on.
I was going to say, it may seem obvious, but I mean, can you tell us a little bit about how you'd find a source maybe you're not connected with yet, but you may know someone who knows someone? I mean, that seems to me like how LinkedIn would be beneficial for journalists.
Using LinkedIn, I typically, I have about, like I said, I have about 650 contacts. Now it's to the point where I can't even manage. I don't know all the names who are my contacts. These are people who have just kind of recognized me or something like that and offered me, offered to be a contact. but they have different titles and they're with different organizations. So LinkedIn will allow you to, for example, Pepsi will have its own sort of group within where it'll identify executives who work at Pepsi. The FDA has officials who are LinkedIn. The reality is we've been around, the newsletter's been around for 55 years, so we know a lot of the top officials in the food industry at both the large companies and the regulatory agencies.
And they may not even be the people you want to use as sources.
Sometimes not.
So, you know.
Yeah.
That's ominous.
But, you know, with LinkedIn, it's funny because I've really been kind of enjoying using it because it is a different experience than Facebook or Twitter. It's very much sort of group oriented that so in that way, it's kind of like Google Plus or Facebook to a degree where you've got shared interests. Yeah. But because it's all sort of, you know, business oriented or, you know, career oriented, it's the people who use it may not be in Facebook or Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so this is their way to sort of organize. Well, I wouldn't mind having a source where I can read about, you know, X, whatever the topic is, you know, food regulation. So I'll join this group and then, you know, that stuff will pop up on LinkedIn and I'll be able to read it there. But those same people wouldn't even conceive of going on Twitter or Facebook. So it's sort of reaching a different sort of strata.
Yeah,
of people.
I think there are a lot of people who will go on LinkedIn who won't touch Facebook, mm-hmm. or if they do, they're like two separate worlds.
Yeah, that's where their family pictures are and their vacation shots and stuff.
I'm bragging about my football team on Facebook, but I won't do that on LinkedIn.
No. Yeah. It's a sort of a different sort of room.
Well, it seems to be different industries too. I know finance, I mean, is big on LinkedIn, and obviously government's big on LinkedIn. I don't know. I mean, it's just an interesting thing to me as a journalist to, if I need a source in a specific industry, that I'd use LinkedIn versus Twitter.
Well, you know, and I've been coincidentally been tasked at Federal News Radio I for our website that we've been sort of talking about. Well, we know that there are a lot of government officials, a lot of people in our industry who are on LinkedIn. You know, how can we, you know, use that to sort of, you know, show some more of our content? So actually I've been tasked the next couple of months that, you know, to lead the effort to enter into that realm. I've already created a LinkedIn page for us, and you know, that's about as far as we've gotten at this point.
Share button.
Yes, a little share button. Yeah, because there's a guy who does one of these mid-afternoon shows who's like a crazy LinkedIn guy who's like, you got to get on LinkedIn. It's the best thing. He does lectures about LinkedIn.
I mean, Jason, you're the first person who we've had as a guest who's mentioned LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something they use. I just think that's interesting because I think a lot of people, especially when they're have a more general audience, they'll go for Facebook or Twitter.
I think that's the exact right thing. General, I think because it's completely set up. It's set up so different than Facebook, but can be used in many of the same ways as Facebook, and just sort of the way you interact with people and sort of talk about shared interests.
You know, it's funny. Years ago, I was the editor of a newsletter that covered home health issues, and we had a listserv, and we had about 1,000
people. Yeah, it's a lot
like
a listserv.
You know, send emails to this listserv, and it was a checker. This was before LinkedIn, and in a way, LinkedIn's like a high-powered listserv. You know, it's like a listserv with a lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah.
So you have all of these communities developing on particular niche areas, and for example, you know, with what you're doing, you might want to find those populations where you happen to have a conversation going. I've actually joined groups on LinkedIn that really aren't food regulation, but at one point or another, I joined a group that was on school administrators because we did a thing on school lunches.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so I actually, just for that one opportunity, and I sent up one of my videos up there,
yeah,
when we were having this conversation, and a lot of people from that group tuned in, watched the video.
It takes a lot. I mean, you've got to put thought into how to use social media to really get the most out of it.
I think it might be an interesting thing to ask Amber about, you know, that transition. We talked a little bit about it, the transition from a more general audience to an industry-specific mm-hmm. audience. I think a lot of, I mean, the jobs that are out there are changing, obviously, for
right.
journalists. And I think a lot of people have considered making that move. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, how that transition went and
going from a broader audience to something more specific.
Yeah, and sort of navigating a new world where you're supposed to know, you know, like
you're
you said, all the jargon
everything.
And all the people
right.
and all that stuff, how that went for you and how long it took.
Well, I mean, I've been with Food Chemical News for almost 5 years now, and I think in some ways what I cover has changed. When I came in, I was covering USDA, the Food Safety and Inspection Service, meat and poultry, things of that nature. Now I'm covering food additives, which is FDA. I mean, so that's, you know, a mile down the road.
You're covering the Clark Griswolds of the world.
Oh. you have to know not just who you're talking to, but what they want to know about. And I think, I don't know, with community journalism, you still get to a point where you have to be specific about the places that you're talking to, the places that you're covering. Mm-hmm. When you're covering government, it's a different world, because the people who you're talking to, when you come into something new like this, they already know way more than you do. Mm-hmm. So you try not to make yourself look like an idiot. I hope that I'm still not making myself look an idiot 5 years out.
It's hard not to do as a journalist. You kind of have to be ready to embarrass yourself and ask stupid questions.
No, we don't.
But that's the thing. I think people appreciate it.
But you can't. You can't in this world.
You know, when you charge a couple grand for a publication, the last thing you want to do is lose your credibility.
Right.
One of the tricks that we teach journalists early on when they get into a new technical area is to have a grounding source.
Mm-hmm.
So you think you got it, right? You wrote the story. You put it down. But are you sure? You have a friendly source that you call up and you say, hey, you don't give them the whole story, but you kind of go through the basic components of the story to kind of say, hey, did I understand this correctly? Am I mm-hmm. using this term correctly? You know, it's kind of a good, and you can do that all throughout the reporting.
Right.
But
there's one other thing, though, that seems to have worked well for me, and that is just saying, listen, this is a new subject for me. I don't know a whole lot about it. Can you explain it to me? Can you really just break it down and explain it to me? And then as you cover a subject, as you cover an area, you learn. And once people realize that you've learned what you're talking about, they're more willing to talk with you, and they'll give mm-hmm. you more detail. They'll give you more information. They're more likely to answer your call or return your email mm-hmm. Because you have built up the credibility. You've worked with them.
And you're not unusual for this, but you were anxious about that initially.
Revealing
that, asking that kind of an honest question.
Right.
Saying, listen, I don't really get this. Could you please explain this in basic
and
terms?
It worked really well.
But most of the time, the sources are incredibly friendly, aren't they?
Right, because the more you understand something, the better you can make them look.
Right.
You know, and you're not coming at it at an angle. I mean, you're fresh. Like, you have no idea of where you're coming.
Right.
So they can kind of, not influence, but they can explain it to you the way they want to explain it to you.
Exactly. And when you're dealing with something like the food industry, they have something they want to say. They want people to know that their product is safe. That they can, you can, you know, feed it to your kids, or in the case of something we've been covering lately, pet treats, that it's safe for your pets. We don't cover pet food a lot, but it does come up from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. If you're honest with people, I think they're more willing to help you. Maybe that's, you know, naive Western New York girl talking, but I think it's true.
No, I think that's a lesson for all journalists, that, you know, to go into it. Obviously, you need to research a little bit what you're doing before you start interviewing people and talking to your sources. But, you know, you gotta be able to admit that you don't know something.
Yeah.
Better than assuming and then having egg on your face later.
Right. Or coming back and having to write a correction the same length as your story.
Right.
Because you got something completely wrong.
Yeah, no, that's...
Which you don't ever want to do.
Those type of lessons usually come pretty early in your career. Usually. But people make mistakes.
Yeah.
Stupid mistakes.
We're human.
Yeah.
You don't want to make a mistake, but owning up to it when you do,
Mike,
that's
important.
I'm
not going to ask you to reveal this, but is there a mistake you made early in your career that you still kind of hang on to?
I have tons of mistakes. I have a great deal of shame that I've carried in my life. No, I've done all types of stupid, thoughtless things. And it's, you know, sloppiness is really what it comes down to, is you got to remember that you're driving the bus. You've got to look in that mirror all the time and just realize that you don't know everything. You know, I always go back every few months. I think back to the Ben Franklin quote, which I don't know exactly, but it basically, the gist of it is that, you know, the most important lesson is to learn is that you don't know everything,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know everything. And, you know, once you start feeling arrogant or like, oh yeah, I understand, you don't go into a story with a preconception. You know, make sure that, you know, think of yourself as representative of the reader, that, you know, that you're there to gather information for them,
mm-hmm.
and you better be able to understand it so that you can write it so that they can understand it. And then also you owe something to your source to make sure that you do it correctly, that you maybe put in a couple extra calls to verify things so that they don't look stupid, because in the long run, that's gonna negatively impact your ability to be a reporter. Mm-hmm. Because that person's not going to talk to you or dismiss you because you just don't do your work professionally. Yeah, it's professionalism.
We covered a lot of stuff that we covered ethics. We covered social media, LinkedIn. We always ask this as a closing question, and it's kind of a doozy. But well, how do you guys feel about, specifically from where you're coming from, industry news? How do you feel about where journalism is going? Do you feel positive about it? Do you feel like, oh my gosh, hang
You've
on?
Got another half hour?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I know. It's hard to sum up.
But. And now the tears begin.
Thanks, Mike.
You know, we're at a crossroads. I feel like that this is a moment in time where we're being tested. And it's not the first time journalism has been through this. Every time a new technology comes along that changes the game, we all have to adjust. And right now, we're trying to figure out how to make this work. And I just feel like the cream rises to the top. Eventually, the people who care about, you know, you were talking before about some basic concepts of journalism. You'd be amazed at how many people who are out there blogging who don't have that kind of in their DNA. You don't really know to do that. They weren't educated as journalists. You need to have that. And I think eventually what will happen is there'll be enough catastrophes in journalism. We'll get to the point where, you know, there's, you know, these organizations that are underfunded that are putting some kids out on the street who don't have enough experience. And there'll be some disasters. And eventually the value of the information will rise to the top. The need for people who can deliver that kind of information will rise to the top. And this is what I tell myself at night to get to sleep. So
I like the fact that you're able to use a food metaphor to
cream.
What about you, Amber? What's your hope? What's your dreams?
What are my hopes and dreams? Are you serious right now?
What are your hopes for journalism at this point?
Well, my hopes and dreams are that the Sabres finally win a Stanley Cup eventually.
It's not going to happen.
We'll be realistic.
Anyway, I think it's simple. I think it's people will always need information. And if people realize that you are a good, solid source of good, solid information, you'll be okay.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation. Thank you very much, Jason and Amber. How can people find out about the Food Chemical News?
Well, I'll give you two websites, foodchemicalnews.com. That's where our newsletter is. And if you can't read the content, at least you can figure out how to get more information about that. And then two would be if you want to check out the videos that we do, youtube.com/TheKnifeAndForkShow. Don't go to Knife and Fork Show or you'll be watching a show about cooking.
Okay.
The Knife and Fork Show will take you to the right place.
Check and check.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.